Today's Taisho will be on Case 32 in the Wulong Kan, the Umen Kwan. A non-Buddhist philosopher questions the Buddha. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, "I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words." The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, "The world-honored one, with his great compassion, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way." After making his bows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked the Buddha, "What did he realize to admire you so much?" The world-honored one replied, "A fine horse runs even at the shadow of the crop." Mumon's comment, Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of the non-Buddhist. I want to ask you, what is the difference between the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Mumon's verse, on the edge of a sword, over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliffs without hands. I would like to thank everybody for coming here to practice today. Of course, this is the middle of the big holiday season in the West, Christmas. And it's a quite a central holiday in the West. This is probably the biggest single religious day. With the exception in the West, with the exception of Easter. But Christmas dwarfs everything else. It's a huge festival, and it combines many elements of pre-Christian practice. So in the old days, before Christianity, there was a winter solstice celebration. And things like the Christmas tree go back to that ancient time where people would bring green boughs into the house and perhaps decorate trees also. And the green tree is a symbol of ever-renewing life. This Christmas holiday was originally, as I say, a winter solstice day. And basically, people would celebrate the darkest day of the year by lighting candles and bringing evergreens into the house. And the idea was that even though it was getting very dark, the cycle was going to renew itself. And out of the darkness, the long dark days, light would come. And out of the cold, dark winter, life would come. So this was like an ancient teaching all over the Western world. And in the Roman world too, this was similar celebration took place. And it involved giving gifts, presents, and other kinds of communal rituals. Now, these sorts of communal rituals are all over the world, not just in the West. So, for example, Chinese New Year is quite a huge celebration. And Japanese New Year also, which takes place on the Western calendar, is also a big celebration. People usually don't cook. In a Japanese tradition, on the New Year, you let the stove go cold. And the hearth go cold, and you eat foods that are like, you know, sushi-type foods that don't have to be cooked. And people go to temples and light incense and prepare themselves for the new year. So anyway, these kinds of rituals are all over the world, and in the West, Christmas is the biggest ritual. And it has absorbed many pre-Christian elements, and it's mixed it up with Christian elements, and also with modern inventions like Santa Claus. So Santa Claus is really the most important deity in Christmas. he's really quite significant. I myself grew up as a little kid, was told there was a Santa Claus, and I was talking to my my sister on the phone, and she said, yes, you know, she has two sons, and she said Santa brought them bicycles, you know. So Santa is really the biggest deity at Christmas, and he's the deity of capitalism, of course. no question about it. I mean, if you're good, you're going to get lots of material things. So he brings you material things from the world of shopping, you know. So the Christmas deity is now a capitalist deity. And he teaches children how to appreciate the consumer society and the sacredness of the consumer society. So anyway, this is a big holiday, and if you're not Christian, or if you're not into Christmas, you know, it can be a little bit alienating. I began to get very tired of Christmas when I was around 18, 19 years old. I remember just beginning to be a little skeptical about the shopping madness, you know. And I would go shopping to buy gifts for my family. And the long lines, it would become very hard work. I remember once, you know, shopping in Seattle at Christmas, and I saw a woman just sit down in a chair and start weeping. You know. She was just exhausted from the ordeal of Christmas, you know. And it occurred to me, you know, this is crazy. You know, this is like, it's like getting on a treadmill and you have to start buying stuff for everybody. And I began to become like a secretly anti-Christmas, you know. I recently read something that was quite interesting. An economist did a study of consumption, and he found that if you buy things for your people who buy things for themselves are generally very happy with the gifts, with the things they buy. So, like, if you want a new car and you pick out the car yourself and you buy it, generally people are very happy with their purchases. But when people give you gifts, generally people aren't very happy with them. This is, an economist said, that when they measure satisfaction, it's quite a bit lower. So they, in this article, somebody was asking the economist, well, what do you think? And he said, the best gift you can give is money. He said, or a gift card, so somebody can buy what they want. Because actually, I would always get presents from my parents and from family members that I didn't want. You know, I remember my father would buy me these clothes that I wouldn't be caught dead in, you know. and it was just like, where did you ever find this? You know, it would be like a, you know, like a light blue sweater with a button on it, you know, and it was just not, I was a hippie, you know, I wasn't going to wear something like that. So, and I began to think, this is kind of a racket, this Christmas thing, you know. People give each other gifts they really don't want, and they spend a ton of money that they really have to pay back at a high interest rate. You know, and then, you know, to top it all off, the gifts aren't really that appreciated, you know. What really is valuable is just getting together with other people, and that's the good part, right? But it gets lost in a sea of commercialism. And I know my mother used to work so hard to get us gifts. She would do extra work. My mother was a court reporter when she was younger, and then she worked as a a stenographer, and she would transcribe legal cases. So when I was a little boy, to make extra money, my mother would, she had what was called a dictaphone. And they used to, this was before good recording devices, they had belts, there were plastic belts that you put on the dictaphone and you'd play it back, and my mother would transcribe this and type it all up, and we were living in Baltimore at the time, and she was typing up legal cases for extra money. And she would buy these toys for us that we would, you know, it was really more toys than we needed, you know, but she had grown up very poor. My mother's family were very, very poor farmers. And they got hardly anything for Christmas, like an orange for Christmas or an apple, you know, things like that, very, very humble gifts. So she wanted us to have a lavish consumer society Christmas, and she would work very hard to give us these gifts that we might or might not be playing with a month later, you know. So as I grew up, I became kind of skeptical about Christmas. And of course, I've gotten interested in Buddhism and Zen. So actually, for me, Christmas is not a big day. I enjoy having a day off, and I enjoy, winter. It's very beautiful. I don't really like to shop very much. And although there's nothing, if you like to shop, that's okay. You know, I'm not really, there's different forms of shopping. You know, you can, it's nice to go to the mall sometime and just look around. And in Seattle, I used to like to go to the stores at Christmas and look at all the cool things. But the race to buy things that pile them high and overwhelm people was, I began to get skeptical about. So anyway, you know, if you're not really into the Christmas thing, this can be, you can feel kind of lonely at Christmas, you know, or you can feel sort of like out of it. So, you know, I'm glad everybody came here today. Even if you had a wonderful Christmas, I'm glad you came. And if you are not really into Christmas too much, I'm glad you came too, because this is a really beautiful experience to practice Zen together on a winter day. We were out in the hall and the wind was blowing. It was very beautiful. We have an upcoming sesshin, and of course, during many sesshins, we've had snow, sometimes a lot of snow, and that's always very beautiful. In the room where we eat our meals, you can see the snow coming down sometime, and it's quite striking, you know. I can remember some sesshins where the snow was blowing very hard. It was very dramatic in that room, in the dining hall. So being together today is wonderful, you know. We're all people who practice the way. One element of human life is kind of like collective rituals, you know. So Christmas is a collective ritual, and it has many dimensions. There is a religious dimension, so many people go to church on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And there's a collective ritual to that, you know. And some people aren't particularly religious, but they take the secular ritual of Christmas very seriously. So they shop religiously, right? I mean, my wife is like that. She buys gifts. She really tries to find a gift that will match the person, you know. So for her, it's when we were living long ago, when our relationship was much younger, my wife was like a Christmas shopaholic, you know. So when she takes Christmas really seriously, she's one of these people who shops until you drop, you know. And I would say to my wife, Barbara, you know, you don't go to church. You're not religious. Why do you take Christmas seriously? And she would say, what does it have to do with religion, you know? It has nothing to do with that, you know. And she was right in a certain sense. You know, for her, Christmas was about giving gifts. But that's a kind of collective ritual, too. It's kind of religious, you know. So for her spirit, I think, is very good. She wants to please the people she loves. So she shops, 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 and gets so tired. And then there's usually like all these boxes to take to the post office that she has to send all over the country to all her family members and friends. But for her, it's a kind of ritual. And of course, she's not alone. Millions of other people are like this. I had to take some of her packages to the post office. And there was this huge line at the post office, all these packages that have to be mailed out. So people are sending packages to each other, and the packages often contain gifts they don't really want. But what they're doing is saying, I love you, and I care about you, and this is a highly ritualized way to do it, you know. And so when people go to church on Christmas Eve, they're celebrating a kind of communal reality, you know. It's kind of communal reality. When they actually send off packages, they're celebrating a kind of communal ritual, and it makes a community. These rituals make the community real, you know. And this is a very important element of human life: is the collective rituals that bind us together, you know. Religious rituals like going to church, and then there are these religious rituals that don't look religious, like shopping at Lord and Taylor, you know. And those are rituals too, and they have a kind of devotional character, and they create a community. And even though my wife's family wouldn't be caught dead in a religious setting, you know, they take Christmas very seriously, you know. This is all really interesting, I think, you know, that people have, that these rituals are a big part of human life, you know. And as I say, if you're not into the Christmas thing, if it's not your holiday, you can feel, you know, left out, you know, or you can feel sort of like, you know, when I was living by myself, on Christmas Eve, I sometimes was with my family, but later, when I was on my own, I would just hang out on Christmas Eve, and, you know, I would go to get Chinese food or something, you know, and have a meal with some friends, but we didn't really celebrate Christmas, you know. These rituals are very important, and they're part of our identity, really, you know. I have given my wife many books on consumer society and its menacing character, you know. But it has no effect on her at all, you know. Even though I could probably get her to agree with many principles, you know, about how corrosive this is and so on, you know, it's like when Christmas approaches, she has to go out and do this. It's like something she has to do. And I understand, you know, it's because there's more at stake than the consumer society. It's really about how she expresses herself, and it's her secular religion, you know. So I appreciate that, and I have long since given up on any attempt to influence her behavior, you know. And I'm happy to see her happy, you know, and I'll even go shopping or take her packages to the post office, you know. These rituals are part of human life. There's no society which can function without them. Like, Chinese New Year is really a celebration of being Chinese. It's really like celebrating Chinese history, you know, and Chinese culture. And it's a celebration of Chineseness, you know. And Japanese New Year is like that too. It's really a celebration of Japaneseness, really. You know, so the Japanese all leave the cold stove cold, and they all, you know, most of them go to the temples, you know. And even if they go to the temples once a year, it's at New Year's, you know, and they light incense and clap their hands, you know, and then they go home and have some, you know, sake or something. And this is like a celebration of collective identity. It's quite important, you know. And it allows us to be members of a group. So, you know, we have other rituals too. So, for example, in America, we have the 4th of July, you know. And the 4th of July is American Independence Day. It's celebrating our successful independence from Great Britain. Many people don't understand what it's about. They know we light firecrackers, you know. And people don't really need to understand what it's about. It's like Christmas. You know, if you ask somebody, what is Christmas about? They might say caroling, or gifts, you know, or the Christmas tree, or white Christmas, or snow bells, sleigh bells in the snow, you know. You know, even most people know the nativity story. They know about the birth of Jesus, even if they're not Christians. But really, Christmas is sort of like a collection of ideas, you know. And the 4th of July is like that. You know, I remember a couple of years ago, a person was going down the street with a microphone, interviewing people and asking them what the 4th of July was about. And hardly anybody could explain it properly, you know. One person said it was it's our independence, and the reporter said, "Independence from who?" And the person said, "France." You know, really, France? You know? And other people, they said, "What is the 4th of July?" And people couldn't explain. You know, I don't know. It's the 4th of July. You know, and what are we celebrating? They didn't know. You know, it's amazing. But they all went and saw the fireworks. You know. And I thought it was funny that many people didn't really understand that it was about the American Revolution or anything like that. But it's not so important, right? It's the idea of doing things together. It's like a collective ritual. And it creates the identity of Americanness, right? So everybody, even people who thought we were fighting a war against France, you know, go and get the flag and hang it out in the front of their house. And then at night they all go to see the beautiful fireworks, and it creates this sense of Americanness. You know? And I think Chinese New Year is like this too. You know, they bring out the guys in the dragon outfits, and they beat the cymbals, you know, and they beat the drums, and they throw the firecrackers and so on. And it's like and go to temples, you know, and it's Chineseness. It creates a common identity. Now, this is all really wonderful. Really wonderful. But, you know, there are problems with this too, you know. You know, that many of the problems we have in the world today, I think, are caused by identity, actually. I understand, I haven't had the chance to read the paper, but I understand that somebody tried to blow up an airplane. Some terrorists tried to blow up an airplane yesterday. I didn't really see the details, but you know, we've been having a lot of conflicts since 9/11, and Americans don't understand any of this very, just as they don't know, generally speaking, what war the American War of Independence was, what country we were fighting against. They know that they're terrorists, but they don't know much beyond that, you know. After 9/11, I became very interested in all of this, and I began to do a lot of reading. And I was surprised that people like Osama bin Laden felt very threatened by the United States. And interestingly, you know, Osama bin Laden and many people who are involved in terrorism are not uneducated people. They're some of very highly educated people. This is one of the great unnoticed details, you know, that many of the people involved in 9/11 had like advanced degrees. In fact, earlier, before 9/11, somebody had tried to blow up the World Trade Towers earlier. They had taken a truck into the parking garage filled with explosives. In fact, one of the people involved was a Rutgers graduate, an engineering student. And I was, had mixed feelings about it, you know. I was hoping he would be successful, given that he was a Rutgers graduate. And an engineer, you would hope that he knew his stuff. But on the other hand, I didn't want the building to be blown up. So he was, they were arrested before they could blow up the building. This was, and I remember reading in the papers he was a Rutgers graduate, and I was ambivalent about that. But the thing is, you know, all of these people are actually highly educated. A lot of them have advanced degrees, and it's, you know, they go through this process where somebody like Osama bin Laden grew up in a part of the world which is really quite traditional. It was like a very traditional society, and I remember reading about it, and It hasn't changed in 1,000 years. And, there's still like an agrarian society. People are all the same. You know, they're all the same. And he, of course, it was very wealthy. His father was somebody who pulled himself up out of poverty and really became a fabulously wealthy person. And Osama bin Laden went to Western schools, and he had a Western education. And at some point, it created this huge conflict in his mind between that world where everybody is the same and this other world where you're surrounded by people who are different from you. And you feel they don't share your values, you know? And this is a big problem, you know. I was invited up to meet a woman. I was invited to give a talk on Zen practice in northern New Jersey. And there's a community up there that's a very nice Zen community. And I met the teacher there. She's a very wonderful person. And I met her husband. And he was from the Netherlands. Her husband was from Holland, right? And he was talking about growing up in his part of Holland. And he said, you know, in my part of Holland, people are still Catholics. They never got on board with the Protestant Reformation. And he said, everybody in my town was a Catholic. And he said, we were all the same. And he talked about how much he missed that, you know? How much he missed that. And of course, you know, I think Osama bin Laden was like that too, you know. People grow up in these societies where everybody's the same. And they're, you know, it's like, it's still the case on TV sometimes you'll hear newsmen say, well, it's Christmas, the whole world is celebrating Christmas. And say, well, wait, not everybody's celebrating Christmas. Muslims aren't celebrating Christmas, you know. There's at least 400 million Buddhists, they're not celebrating. There's 900 million Hindus there, you know. But there's a kind of desire for everybody to be the same, you know. And I think that people like Osama bin Laden, you know, feel very, very threatened by a world in which everybody's not the same. In fact, it's not just an Islamic thing, you know. It's not at all. I mean, that Dutch man was telling me how nostalgic he was for a world where everybody was, everyone he knew was a Catholic. And on Christmas Day, everyone he knew was in church, you know. It's so reassuring, you know, it's so reassuring. It's like everything is in order, the whole world is in order, you know. And people want that to a great degree, you know, they want that sense of orderliness, you know, and community and harmony, you know. It's so beautiful when everybody's the same, you know, in a certain sense. And you feel, oh, this is how life was supposed to be. This is how it's supposed to be. And I think as somebody like Osama bin Laden, you know, these people come to the West, and then it begins to create a kind of conflict in their hearts, you know, because they've come here, and it's a crazy place, you know. It's very different, it's like if you're a Muslim on Christmas Day, you know, unless you're surrounded by other Muslims, you can feel very lonely, you know, or if you're a Buddhist on Christmas Day, you could feel very lonely, because it's like the whole world is going somewhere and I'm not going, you know. And I think that is difficult for some people to take, you know, that's hard to take. All of these rituals create a kind of collective identity, and that's good to a certain degree. But it creates a lot of tension. A lot of the problems in the modern world have to do with collective identity and the threats to collective identity and the desire to preserve a collective identity, you know. And the West is not innocent at all. You know, the West really comes into some countries like a steamroller, you know, and it brings in the TV, it brings in the consumer culture, it brings in, you know, undermines traditional society. There's many dimensions to this, you know. So, you know, there's a woman whose work I like. Her name is Helena Norberg Hodge. She was a United Nations Development Officer. She's an economist and a scientist and a biological scientist. She's like got multiple diplomas, and she was sent to Ladakh, which is a region in the Himalayas, in the Himalayas. And it's a traditionally, about a third of the population is Muslim, and about two-thirds of the population is Buddhist, like Tibetan Buddhists. And she was sent there to help these people become, quote-unquote, developed. And she got there, she's from, I think, Sweden. And she got there, and her mission was to bring these people into the 20th century. This was late 20th century. And she said, when I got there, she said, I was so surprised because she said, you know, actually they had a very effective local economy. It was very effective. And it worked very well. They had relatively high standard of living. They had a pretty good life expectancy. And they were like a traditional society. And so they had a high level of social coherence. And she said, you know, actually, if you think ecologically, the way they live is very effective, very good. You know, they don't produce plastics and so on. And she said, you know, as she began to have very mixed feelings about, quote unquote, bringing these people into the 20th century, because she said their way of life was so good. And they had very high levels of satisfaction with their lives. And she said, you know, actually, as they develop, they become less happy, you know. And she said, actually, they undergo a lot of social disruptions. And she said, there's more pollution, right? I mean, suddenly you have all this, you know, manufactured junk and so on. And she said, really, you know, we don't always measure economics properly, because, you know, if the water gets dirty, the water in the streams is too dirty, you have to buy bottled water. And when you buy bottled water, it increases economic activity, but it's really a decline in some ways in the quality of life, not a gain, even though your level of trade goes up, you know. So she's tried to integrate traditional culture with a modern culture. You know, so solar energy, she's helped to bring in solar energy and simple solar technologies and things like that. But the point is as the world is changing, it can seem uncontrollable, and people can be overwhelmed by change, and they can lose track of who they are and where they came from and so on. And they can begin to feel very powerless and disoriented, and you get a lot of social problems from this, you know. So, like, if you look in the American inner cities, you know, often people don't have skills, they don't have education, there's very weak social ties, there's a lot of crime. So that's a big problem, you know. So anyway, a lot of the problems in the world are caused by, like, collective identity, you know. We feel threatened, we try to preserve it, and sometimes it looks very much like a war, you know, very violent. So I think that, you know, Buddhism is kind of unusual, you know. I think it's rather an unusual way of life, because it's not about being a Buddhist. See? I think that's quite interesting. You know, the Buddhism is really quite different. You know, because the Buddha did not really say, you know, essentially you should be a Buddhist. Essentially you should be a Buddhist. He said that essentially people are empty. You know, fundamentally we're empty. And this means that really our true nature is non-identity. 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 So when you sit down on the cushion and you straighten your back and you watch your breath, eventually you're going to go to this place that is like blank or empty. And at first you might not like it very much, but if you stay there, you're going to feel very good. You know, it is true that, you know, if you peel away the layers of your mind, it is like an onion, you know? And so you take off the first layer, and that's like the layer that says, I have to go to the grocery store, you know? And then you take the next layer, and it's the layer that is not thinking in complete statements, but it's just like mumbling all the time, muttering, you know? And then there's memory, and there's images, and you keep peeling this away, and finally you get to the center of the onion, and there's no center. It's just empty. But in this emptiness, most remarkable thing happens, you know. First of all, in the emptiness, there's tremendous energy. It's like this beautiful pulsing energy. This is quite important, you know. This beautiful life energy. So even though we're afraid of emptiness, even though we're afraid of being nothing, and psychologically and existentially, it's quite difficult to deal with that. When we sit on the cushion and we practice the Buddha's way, we discover that at the core of the self there's this emptiness, and that instead of being like this horrible thing, you know, I'm no one, I'm nothing, which is really like our worst nightmare, at the core of the self there's this emptiness, but it's so life-giving and sustaining and purifying. The Diamond Sutra, I mean the Heart Sutra, says, you know, that no matter what your problems, and it may take a month or two, no matter what your problems, if you keep going back to this emptiness, your problems will dissolve and you will be set free. It says there's nothing it can't dissolve. And I believe it. You know, from my own experience, I've had many obstacles, some of them very difficult to work through, but it seems to work. So anyway, you know, at the core of the human being is a kind of spacious emptiness. And in that emptiness, we feel very connected to everything around us. And the more you go there, if you're not dozing, if you're really in the emptiness, you know, you can feel like not only this tremendous energy, but this tremendous sense of love. It's like you feel, in Buddhism this is called compassion, right? You feel deep compassion, even for things like stones, right? And you know, trees. The boundary between yourself and the world disappears, and you feel this incredible compassion. Now, this is the essence, in my opinion, of Buddhism. It isn't about identity. It's not about being a Buddhist. It's about encountering non-identity. And then in that non-identity, we experience our oneness with everything around us. Now, this is not easy to do. It's hard to achieve this experience. And then sometimes it's hard to have oneness when we feel threatened, disoriented, valueless, frightened, and so on. You know, you have to do a lot of zazen. But if you stay in that emptiness long enough, your heart opens up and you feel this deep compassion and connectedness to things. It's like one life, one great life. This is the path of the Buddha, you know. But it's not to be a Buddhist. Right? Now, if people ask me, am I a Buddhist, I say yes, you know. But they don't understand what I mean, you know, because they don't understand this path. But it's not about saying, this is my identity. This is my identity. And so I think Buddhism is quite unique. I think it's like an experiment. You know, it's like an experiment, a social experiment. Can we have, see, I mean, I think most human solidarity, most human connectedness is based on identity. So on Chinese New Year, everybody goes to light, you know, to have the dragon dance and the meal, collective meal, and maybe go to the temple. And it says, we're all Chinese here. We're all Han here. You know. And the Japanese people all go to temples on New Year's Day, and they're all saying, we are Japanese. You know, this is great. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's part of life. And on Christmas, Christians all get together and go, we're Christians. You know. This is great. Right? And on Ramadan, people don't eat all day long, and they get together at night and they eat, and they're saying, we're Muslims. You know, we're Muslims. And this is very important. Buddhists do this too. Buddhists have rituals too. You know, but I do think it's somewhat different because at the heart of it, it's not about identity. So I think Buddhism is a little bit unique. And maybe that's just because I practice Buddhism, you know. But I do think it's different because it really is about, can we have a community? Can we have human community that's based on non-identity? You know, not based on our likeness. See, not on what makes us similar, but it's a community big enough for our differences. I think this is a real problem. It's a real human problem. Because, you know, usually, you know, I mean, I can't help it, you know. I studied Arabic for 3 years when I was in graduate school. And I actually used to be able to read the papers in Arabic, and I could translate and so on. It was one of my languages for graduate school. And years ago, I got into a cab with a man who was a Muslim. And we started talking about Arabic poetry and Islam. And he said, you know so much about... I recited verses from the Quran to him. And he said, my God, he said, are you a Muslim? And I said, no, I think Islam is beautiful, but I'm not a Muslim. He was stunned. No, really, I mean, it's so human. He thought, how can you know all this and not be a Muslim? And his feelings were hurt. You know, I said, no, but I can understand this, you know. Because, I mean, when I actually got into Zen, I just thought, this is it for me, you know. And I kept saying to my wife, look at this, you know. Isn't this amazing? You know, and her face would just be like blank, like, no. Polite, you know. I'm glad you like it, you know. But I was just like, how can you not hear these, you know, beautiful sentiments? That be, you know, so I understand exactly where he's coming from. And of course, you know, many people, not all people in my family were Christian, but a lot of them were Christian. And of course, you know, the first thing they do when they meet a non-Christian is to start thinking, how can I make this person into a Christian? You know, and then if they're not a Christian, what's wrong with them anyway? How can this be? Religions often talk about brotherhood, but it often means the brotherhood of the believers, right? It's based upon our being the same. So that cab driver was literally astounded that I could have such an appreciation for Islam and not be a Muslim. And of course, I actually know quite a bit about Christianity, and And of course, some people in my family have never forgiven me for not being a Christian, you know. And they can't understand it, you know. My brother's mother-in-law told my nephew that I was going to hell, you know. Because I had turned my back on the truth, you know. Now, the thing is, I'm pretty confident that I'm not going to hell, you know. But it, you know, hurt my feelings, you know. And it's you know, how can we have a this world where we don't all, we're not all the same, but we feel a deep sense of oneness, you know. And I think what we call Buddhism has a contribution to make to this, you know. Because, you know, we're never going to be the same. Even people who are Christians don't actually, even if they're in the same church, they actually don't have the same beliefs. They don't. People who are devout in any tradition will quickly get into an argument when you get down to particulars. You know. And that's because, really, in a certain way, it's really just our doing things together that defines us as a community. It's not necessarily what we really believe. You know. But the point is that I think Buddhism has a unique contribution to make, because it's like an experiment. It's saying, can we have oneness? Can we have a kind of community spirit without believing the same things? You know, it's not based on, you know, I've often thought some people in my family are Catholics, and I've noticed how rarely they refer to themselves as Christians. You know, they always talk about themselves as Catholics. And I think that's interesting, and I realized, you know, the religion of Catholicism is about being a Catholic, actually. That's what it's all about, you know. This sounds a little cynical, but that's true. You know, Catholic. And actually, Judaism is like that, too. It's all about being Jewish, right? And Islam is like that. It's all about being a Muslim. And if you don't practice Buddhism properly, it's all about being a Buddhist. You know? But the Buddha said, you know, ultimately, at the heart of the human being, there's this emptiness. It's not Buddhist. It's not Christian. It's not Muslim. It's not Jewish. You know, and so it's a kind of an experiment. It's saying, can we have community based on non-identity? You know, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think all of these forms of identity are based upon a kind of ambivalence about who we really are. It's like, I've never really felt like an American, you know? I've always thought that was kind of baloney, you know? It's like, my father used to say, you're a red-blooded American boy. And I used to think, what the hell does he mean, you know? What does that mean, anyway? And I think it's phony, you know? And maybe all identity is a kind of game we play with ourselves, right? You know, where we decide, I'm going to really try hard to be an American. You know, what would that mean? You know? Everybody does this, though. You know, I mean, people do this. You know, I'm sure in Mexico people really want to be muy Mexicano, you know? Whatever that means. But I think on some level we know, I even think people like Osama bin Laden know that you can't ever be really Muslim enough, you know. That's why America is so threatening. And you know, at the heart of our being, there's a kind of emptiness there that we try to cover up with these identities. When I was young, I used to go to church, you know. And I read the Bible actually several times when I was a teenager. I didn't understand much of it, but I dragged myself through it. You know. And I remember the more I read, the less I could believe in any of this stuff. You know, and I remember talking to the minister at our church and saying, you know, I'm really going through a crisis of faith. And he really tried to reassure me that these were things that were beyond my understanding. You know, nobody could really understand them. And I didn't find this satisfying, you know. But when I think back on it now, I think, you know, basically, you know, I think we're a little bit afraid of the fact that these are just stories and we know it, and at the center of the human being is a kind of emptiness. And we don't know what to do with that. And so we you know, it's like we reassert our collective identity as a way of not confronting that emptiness. And so, you know, encountering other belief systems is very threatening sometimes, because it reminds us that we are living a kind of dream, you know. And then we have to reassert our dream. And if Buddhism is just another collective dream, then nothing much has been gained, you know. But I don't think it is. I think it's saying, let's look at that emptiness, you know. I mean, basically, the clouds are not Buddhist. You know, the trees are not Buddhist. It's not a Christian world, Christian universe. It's not a Muslim universe, you know. These are just human inventions. There's something, I think, bigger than these ideas, you know, about life. And I think we can tap into it when we are not in our small selves, you know, when identity is not the issue. Somehow being in that emptiness allows us to connect in very powerful ways, you know, with ordinary people, no matter who they are, or trees or stones, you know. And animals, you know. I think this is true. Now, everything I've said is debatable, and you're certainly free to, you know, just throw it out the window. It's just my opinion, but I think there's some truth to this. So, a non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, "I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words." The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, "The world-honored one, with his great compassion, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way." After making bows, he took his leave. You know, the Dalai Lama has said, he said, "Compassion is my religion." You know, that's my religion, is just compassion, you know. Whatever gets you to compassion compassion is what it's all about, you know. It's why we do zazen, you know, really. And, you know, zazen is about getting free from our illusions, but when you're free from your illusion, it's compassion that you encounter. And our fears, you know. When we're free from our fears, we experience compassion. You know, basically, I don't think you can be deeply compassionate and then say to somebody, "Oh, you don't share my religion," you know, or "you don't share my value system." When we're really in a deep, we're really in Buddha mind, you know, the compassion is so great that it doesn't care about those distinctions. So, the philosopher said admiringly, "The world-honored one, with his great mercy, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way." After making bows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked the Buddha, "What did he realize to admire you so much?" And the world-honored one said, "A fine horse runs even at the shadow of the crop, the riding crop." So, you know, that's a strange statement. It sounds like the Buddha's saying we should whip horses, right? But he's not saying that. The Buddha was a Kshetri person. His group were the fighters and the chieftains in his group. You know, his group were like soldiers. So, he was trained to be an arrow, you know, marksman, swordsman, horseback expert. He was given an education for like a military education, actually. And so sometimes the Buddha uses warrior metaphors to speak. He'll say, it's like, you know, wrestling, or he, in this case he's saying it's like a riding whip. What he said, what he really means is that he said, you know, there's some horses that you do have to strike with the crop on the bottom to get them to trot well, you know. And he said, but there's some horses, all they don't even have to see the crop. They don't even have to see the whip. They just see the shadow of the whip and they run. And what he means is some people believe that culture is real and some people know it's just a shadow. It's not real. So to say I'm Jewish and you're Christian, that's actually not real. Or to say I'm Buddhist and you're Muslim, that is not real. Now, you know, some people need these strong beliefs to act compassionately, but it's very dangerous, you know. And the better path is to inhabit culture lightly. We need structures, we need symbols, but don't take them too seriously. See, the person who's noble doesn't count too much on structures and beliefs. The person who is like a more well-developed human being acts spontaneously from the true self through cultivating emptiness. So the Buddha says, look, a really good horse doesn't have to be whipped in order to be good. The really good people don't need to be afraid. They don't act from fear. They act from love. So make yourself like a good horse. You know? Okay. So Mumon's comment, Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of a non-Buddhist. So the koan setting you up to say, Buddhist, non-Buddhist? Of course, that's the discriminating mind, right? I want to ask you, what difference is there between the Buddha's disciple and a non-Buddhist? Mumon's verse, on the edge of a sword, over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliffs without hands. See, you know, I think Buddhism is an experiment. It's like, is it possible for people to be like post-cultural human beings? You know, post-cultural human beings. We live in culture, but we don't believe in it. See? We use ideas, but we don't take them seriously. We know they're dreams, right? So Buddhism is about like post-cultural human beings. It's like climbing a cliff with no hands. You know, you need hands to hold on to the cliff. You need words to express yourself. You need ideas to act. But actually, you know, if you cling to them too much, you create terrible divisions between yourself and the world, and one person and the next. You know, so you have to live in culture lightly. It's like wear your culture clothes lightly, right? And you really are, underneath your clothes, you're really a naked person. In fact, you're not really even a human being. You know? So I think being alive means learning how to live with that nakedness, you know? Now, there's different kinds of nakedness. The other day, my wife and I had gone to sleep. I went upstairs and I went to sleep. And my wife watches the tube and falls asleep on the sofa. So around 2 in the morning, somebody pounded on the door and said, Barbara, Kurt. And Barbara woke up and she came upstairs and woke me up. My father-in-law, my 90-year-old father-in-law, he sleeps naked. And he's a 90-year-old man, so believe me, it's a sight, it's something to look at. You know. He's amazingly wrinkly and saggy, you know. So anyway, he had gone outside naked, and it was like 27 degrees outside. And we were asleep. We didn't know. He let himself out the front door. And the guy who found him was Oscar, our neighbor, who works late and was walking his dogs at like 2 in the morning. And Oscar, and Jack said to Oscar, We're going, we're leaving, we've got to deliver these packages. So apparently he takes a medication called Ambien, which can produce these like waking dream type hallucinations. So this morning also, I was about to get up to go to the sit and the phone rang. And Jack had, he called on the phone, he called us, you know, we're upstairs. And I went downstairs and Jack said, when are we going to make the ice cream with the ice cream maker? And I said, Jack, we don't have an ice cream maker, you know. But he had gone through one of these dreams where he was sure that we were going to all get up and make ice cream. So anyway, there's nakedness like that, you know. There's another kind of nakedness, which is this nakedness where you're in deep mushin, and let's say, you know, something's bothering you. You know, we all have obstacles. You know, we're afraid, we're, you know, sit on the cushion, sit on the cushion, sit on the cushion. You're in that emptiness and you think, I'll never get free from these obstacles. You know, I'll never free myself. But you know, one day you just get up and you feel better. Or you're sitting on the cushion and all of a sudden you feel better. And then your heart is full of love, you know. And that's the nakedness I'm talking about, right? There's a fundamental beauty at the heart of ourselves, you know, that we have such high standards for ourselves. We set such high standards, and we can be so hard on ourselves, but at the heart of the human being, at the heart of yourself, there's this beauty, this great compassion and love, and it's just wonderful. And this is the real nakedness that we have to take care of, you know. So anyway, thank you for coming today. I look forward so much to our next opportunity to practice together. It's always a great pleasure to see everybody here. And now we have the New Year coming up, so Happy New Year. And then we have a Sesshin coming up. So some of you might be going to Sesshin, and that will be wonderful too.